Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Welcome to Progress for Democracy. This is Brian Stetson with co-host Ruth Ann Aramarte Feo, who will be in and out of this episode, and our guest, Kelly McNulty, who's with us now. Hi,
hello.
Kelly. Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing today? I am doing great, and I guess I'll introduce you some more in a bit, and obviously, progress toward democracy. We always start off by discussing how we lost democracy. But, or as Ed Snowden told New Yorker magazine, the famous NSA whistleblower that's now residing in Russia, because if he steps out, he'll end up in jail here. We are no longer citizens, and we no longer have leaders. We are subjects, and we now have rulers, which is in a system of capitalism that's run exclusively by finance capital. I guess that's what we best can expect. So, they tell us that we shouldn't think of class warfare, the rich attacking the poor and so forth. We're all supposed to be one happy family, poor, middle class, rich, all together under the banner of our flag. And actually, there was a character by the name of, what was his name? Benito Mussolini. He pushed the notion of class collaboration, you know, that all classes are basically working together and bounded together by nationalism, and even sort of symbolized it as rods of wood being bounded together as a bundle, which is called a fascist. Take a wild guess as what the name of his ideology is called. Kelly?
I'm not sure.
Fascism.
Fascism,
so,
okay.
Basically, and the symbol base of the bundle of sticks, at the end of it, an axe, which meant the power of the republic to have, or the republic's power over of life, over of life and death, I guess. So it was not much has changed. Is there fascism in our society? Well, we're not all ultra-nationalistic. We're not highly totalitarian, but there's certainly elements of it in our society. Some have described Tea Party as being proto-fascist. Economically, in some ways, we are, because Mussolini and Hitler both believe that the capitalist class should be preserved because they made for a very strong state. And that's a strong state that you want to further militarize. So, unfortunately, we have some of those elements as well. But outright fascism like they had and so forth, no, I don't think so. But one thing we certainly have is a plutocracy. And the rich seem to have clear control of society. And nowhere was this more demonstrated than this past Saturday night when Congress, or specifically the Senate, aggressively pushed a new spending bill, some $1.1 trillion, so-called Cromnibus, which had to be probably the most massive class warfare assault on the bulk of the population ever pushed through in a single night, especially a Saturday night when the news cycle isn't even covering it. If you just didn't happen to be watching C-SPAN 2 at the time it was occurring, you didn't know. It was I thought almost surreal, and some bill it was, something like a major gift to Wall Street was in there, the Dodd-Frank Act, basically Dodd-Graham, basically ensured that taxpayers would no longer be on the hook for the reckless gambling by Wall Street on derivative trading, that the investment banks, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and so forth would set up subsidiaries which would not be covered by FDIC insurance. So if they failed, they would be on the hook. Taxpayers wouldn't be. That's been reversed. And so taxpayers are on the hook. They want to keep it that way because that gambling, even though it's very dangerous, is immensely profitable. And so reckless trading on credit swaps based on mortgage-backed securities and so forth, and God knows what else will continue. And also had budget cuts to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, which attempts to regulate some of the more exotic trades of Wall Street. That budget cut obviously is going to make it harder to regulate that industry, which badly needs to be regulated. $300 million cut to programs such as Section 8 housing. Another $300 million cut to programs to give homes to the poor, I mean, basically sheltered programs for those that are homeless. There was even an assault on animal rights in there. The sage grouse is a bird that's been driven to extinction in part by the increased fracking activity in some of the southern states. So it's been on its way to being officially becoming an endangered species, which would give that species some protection, banned from being put on the endangered species list in that spending bill. A whole host of things. Yeah, I mean, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Another crazy bit was an attack on truckers, in a sense, although some of the truckers might not feel that way because they're, like everybody else, wages have gone down, so they're desperate to make a buck, too. But safety laws were put in place a year ago because you had truckers that were driving up to 82 hours a week, you know, driving themselves into exhaustion. And OSHA, the Office of Safety and Health Administration, has been somewhat concerned because the number one cause of worker-related deaths have been on the road, with truckers contributing quite a bit to that. They get exhausted, they get killed, so there were rules in place to make sure that they sleep somewhat and try to limit it to 70 hours. And this is going well beyond the 40-hour work week. That's all been repealed, so they can drive up to 82 hours a week again. The 40-hour work week, by the way, is long gone. The average work week is 47.
Wow.
Yeah, so we work longer. We work longer hours in our European cohorts, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The Environmental Protection Agency had its budget significantly cut. It's expected to see its staffing levels reduced to lows not seen since 1989. In a time when industry seems to be desperate to make a buck and pollution's been on the increase, that's the last time that's the last thing we should be doing is cutting back on that, but we are.
Yeah.
I
think the interesting thing is that it was done in the middle of the night, so it tells you how secretive they're trying to keep everything from people.
Yeah. Basically, unless you're super politically aware and so forth, the average person has no idea.
No clue.
Yeah. And it's big-time class warfare assault. Yeah, and it needs to be perceived that way, but it's not. You know, it's instead people will think of it as cronyism or something, or will tend to defend one political party over another, but they both went through with it. You had Elizabeth Warren, I guess, is considered a great hero for standing up for the and trying to push back against the portion that was a gift to Wall Street, but there was a lot else in the bill that was pretty bad, too. And obviously, it's not a good thing, and that's only part of it. So it's an awful bill. Hopefully, I mean, there are some people sitting back saying, well, maybe Obama will veto it. And don't count on it.
No.
No, don't count on it. Yeah. So
I
again,
think
we're,
the only
we're,
hope is that, you know, the ramifications of this will be seen by people, and hopefully it will inspire some sort of backlash in people to really actually do something.
I hope so. I think some of the Democrats that I talked to that are more left-leaning got pretty angry. I mean, now they're backpedaling a little bit, and, well, maybe Obama had no choice. They had no, you know, and so forth, and it still look bad if the government shutdown is going to be occurred, it would have been put on them rather than the Republicans this time. Well, I mean, the Republicans took full blame for the government shutdown the last time, and by the time the election came around, people forgot about it anyway, and they didn't even bother coming to vote for the most part, because
right.
We had the lowest voter turnout since 1942. So, I mean, I think the politicians themselves are just too isolated from the rest of the world. It's not reality there on Capitol Hill. Yeah. And they're wheeling and dealing, and they just simply don't realize the ramifications of what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but yeah, I thought Saturday night was very surreal. And it should be considered a very bizarre situation for it to occur. Late night
yeah.
on a Saturday, of all things. Another bizarre thing I thought that occurred was a so-called hostage situation in Australia yesterday that was portrayed as some type of Islamic terrorist attack, almost promoted by all the Western media that way, including American Western media. CNN, MSNBC all highlighted it. And it was basically just a nutcase that held several people hostage, which is bad. And a few people got killed, including the hostage taker, which is bad. Radical Muslim, perhaps. But also, apparently, the guy had a history of mental illness. He claimed that he was an Ayatollah from Iran. And, you know, and other people in the Muslim community recognized him as a nut. You know, he may have been implicated in the murder of his wife and was out on bail, and it's questionable whether he should have been out on bail. So I mean, there's all these things that make it sort of clear that it's not really some major, it's not Al-Qaeda, it's not Al-Nusra, it's not Islamic State. It was a lone guy that was a nut, but it was portrayed as quite the opposite on all the major media. And you had round-the-clock coverage of this incident, hour after hour, which is fascinating. I mean, the media, well, I think it's not so much the media is playing up to the state, and, well, the state, you know, wants to be aggressive toward Middle Eastern countries and will help them. I just think it's fear makes dollars, and it makes good rating sense. They knew a good portion of the audience would keep their eyes glued on the TV, and they succeeded. You know, so it's just fear, which equals Islamic terrorists, equals ratings. And boy, did it go for it. But it ends up promoting Islamophobia in a terrible way. But you know, what I thought was interesting was how Australia was pushing it that way. And the current Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, just went after it as that kind of situation, and how Americanized, and I'm referring to the worst aspects of American culture, Australia has become. It's really unusual for that country. A few years ago, me and Ruth Ann had a conservative who was anti-fracking activist, but a conservative from Australia on our show.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he considered people on the left to be nuts, actually. But you talk to this guy, and he was to the left of our Democrats. You know, very critical of finance, capital, you know, his Wall Street. I forget the name of what they call it there, and so forth. And it's just, you know, extremely liberal in many ways. And if he considers lefties crazy, it's like, you know, what are their lefties? Because he came across as a almost, you know, to the left of some American liberals. It was very, I mean, the country is tends to be more liberal for a good reason, because in Australia, voting is compulsory. The entire population has to vote. And when everybody has to vote, it tends to shift the politics to the left. You know, the poor have to vote and so forth. If you don't vote, you pay, you know, some fine or something. So everybody has to vote. It increases participation, so it shifts the country to the left. I mean, you see what happens here. When people are disillusioned and don't show up, well, look who wins. Republicans, right?
Right.
You know, when voter participation drops down, it shifts to the right.
Yeah.
So that system has always tended to be more liberal. But over the past few years, there's been, and this is what I thought was out, there's been a Tea Party movement in Australia. And, okay, while there's been a Tea Party movement in the United States, simultaneous to that, you know, because we had the Boston Tea Party in our history and so forth, you've had a rise of fascist movements throughout Europe. And those countries have had a history of fascist movements, right? You have Nazi parties.
Right.
So you have neo-Nazi parties in Greece. You had Golden Dawn and so forth. You know, there's a nationalist movement in England that's very fascist and was across the board. Well, Australia doesn't really have that tradition. I mean, they don't really have a tradition of a fascist party in their past. And I mean, obviously, Tea Party is kind of bizarre. So only other country on this planet besides the United States to have a Tea Party movement, which I thought was kind of surreal. But some very rich people have gotten much richer in that country over the past decade, too. For example, there's a woman who's rapidly gotten very wealthy by the name of Gina Reinhart. She was a iron ore heiress who basically apparently is making $1 million every 30 minutes. she's expected to be wealthier than Bill Gates over the next decade. And she is quite the character. She's known to be fairly racist. Her father, who was pretty wealthy, Lang Hancock, he was extremely racist, known for stating that, referring to the Aborigine people there, that the no-good half-castes should collect their checks from a centralized location where he could dope their water so they would be sterile and not be and breed themselves out of existence. You know, but this Gina Reinhart pushed for laws to try to make the mining industry more competitive with the miners in Africa. She wanted to see wages for miners cut to $2 an hour. Not a nice person, obviously. Very powerful, and threw lots of money at climate denialism campaigns. Another powerful person there is Rupert Murdoch, who we know as owner of Fox News, or I would say largest shareholder in News Corporation, which owns Fox News, which is actually headquartered in Australia. So Fox News empire, belly of the beast, is actually Australia, believe it or not. So it's just, one has got to wonder, has that culture been impacted in some major way by the media over the last few years, and as you know, the worst of American conservatism sort of transformed the culture there. You know, what do you think of that notion,
sure.
Kelly?
Well, I'm sure it has. I mean, we live in a global society now, and I know that Australia does have a lot of conservative movements. It does have a lot of similarities to the United States, in that you have an indigenous culture that was conquered by a dominant white culture. So it's got a history of oppression and Also a history of conquering the environment and nature, got a natural world there that, you know, has been conquered. There's a history of hunting, things of that nature. So it doesn't surprise me that they would have a conservative movement like ours. Their culture is similar. And the fact
but
that
it's, it's taken over their politics in a major way, because Tony Abbott
right.
is a fanatically right-wing climate denialist.
Right.
They did implement a carbon tax. He reversed it. They have a very successful health insurance, health care system, and which is mostly public and some private, but mostly public. And actually, of all the health care systems in the world, they have, in some ways, it's probably the best, because they have the greatest life expectancy out of all of them, even beating Japan. Australia. They have the business, the power of business class there has gotten very bad. You were talking about what they do to animals and so forth. It was the business communities at some of the beach communities there that have pushed for shark culling.
Right.
You know, to make sure it doesn't hurt the tourist industry. And so they've gone nuts, actually, over killing sharks.
I'm not surprised by the fact that they would have a movement similar to ours. Not to mention that I believe their culture is, I think it's wedded in the same, you know, type of history that we have had of the English conquering, you know, like I say, the indigenous land. So it has a very similar history when you look at it, from what I understand.
They have a native population that's fairly oppressed.
Right.
The Aborigines. Yeah. So that's there. So tell us about your background.
Well, I have a background in writing and the legal field. Most of my life, I've been involved with writing essays and poetry and things of that nature. And so I have a undergraduate in liberal arts, which focuses mostly on English and history. And then I have a master's degree from George Washington University in paralegal studies. My purpose of going into the legal field was to work in public interest law, mostly focusing on animal and environmental law. However, I was disenchanted by the opportunities that our, you know, society provides in terms of that. So unfortunately, I'm not working in that sector at the moment. But currently, I am working on my poetry. As you know, I recently lost my mother, Gloria Gilmore, and she was the person that inspired me to be an activist, mostly for animals and the environment. Since I was a child, you know, if she saw an animal on the street, we would either feed it or take it home, one or the two. And I was surrounded by animals my entire life. We always had dogs, cats, birds, you know, all kinds of creatures. And when I became 21, I started learning, you know, about animals in factory farms. And I remember the day, I think it was September 21st, 2001, I was in my biology class and I saw Diet for New America, and I called my mom and I said, we have to go vegetarian. And my mom was a person that was always open, very open person, mm-hmm. very liberal, very easy to change. So when I, you know, announced that to her, it wasn't difficult for her to make that change. And from there, I became more involved with the animal rights movements. I learned more. I became more outspoken about it. I became very, very disillusioned by the fact that people weren't like my mom and weren't as easy to change as she was. You know, my mom also was involved with the human rights thing. She was very, always very compassionate to children, to homeless people. My mom and grandmother both, you know, had very open minds. I was never raised with any kind of racism or prejudice. I was always exposed to different cultures and different cuisines and different ideas. They were just both very open-minded, revolutionary women, I think.
Well, she was a brilliant person, and I loved her very much.
Yeah,
and she was very intelligent.
Yeah.
And I guess I made her more anti-capitalist.
Yeah, you did make her a little bit more anti-capitalist. And, you know, so mostly I'm just trying to expand upon what she did and, you know, help animals and do more work for that. I think that's her biggest thing was, you know, she definitely had a very, very, very deep emotional state. I mean, if she saw an animal or a human in distress, I mean, it would be something that would just tear her up for days. She had images in her mind constantly, you know, so she was very troubled by seeing anything in distress or anything in pain, anything suffering. And, you know, she felt that the great equalizer was the fact that we all have the ability to suffer. So regardless of what your beliefs are about animals, we always believed that animals had souls and spirits, but regardless of whether you did believe that or not, the fact is that they can suffer and therefore they deserve, you know, respect. And she had a deep love for the ocean, for the environment. She was a very active person, so she loved to be outside, and, you know, therefore she did to preserve that as well. She was very educated. You know, I think the biggest thing about my mom is she was always learning, you know, always trying to discover new things, new ideas. She was not a conformist, so even though she might believe in one group of ideas, she also had her own individualism.
Very much so.
Things even about the left and liberalism that she disagreed with, and she had no problem with letting people know that and letting her, you know, letting people know her own ideas. And I think that's something that's important too, because no one maybe necessarily agrees with 1,000% of every single movement. There's differences in individuals. Okay.
I would say the strongest people on the left are the most individual. You know, I mean, it's a right wing view of the left. Is the left promotes a type of collectivism and loss of individualism, which is false. That's actually totally false. I mean, the strongest leftists I know are the most individual people I've ever known, and usually it's those that. That are encouraging a cult of personality or some type of group like One Struggle, which I've criticized, which is dogmatic. You know, you have to talk in a specific Marxist way or something. Then that's very troublesome. You know, you need individualism because that's what creates democracy. You know, but unfortunately, what we call individualism in American society is more individualism defined by what you consume, what you buy. I mean, but which is not what your mother was about at all. I mean, she was a very strong-willed person.
She was. Well, I guess I'm going to share a few poems. I printed out several poems about my mom and her passing, and then I also printed out three activism poems. I have about 300 poems that I've written. And I have different categories. Some are about family and my mom. Some are about activism. And I have other categories as well. But I think the first poem I'll share tonight is called Like a Dream. And it's a poem that I wrote when I first learned, actually, about my mom's diagnosis with cancer. And I just kind of went into that state of feeling that everything was unreal, like a dream, and so this inspired.
Yes, and so to remind audience that may not know, Gloria Gilmore was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer about 5 months ago, right? About five and a half months ago now, and passed away.
August 26th.
Okay, a little longer than that, and she passed away October 31st of this year.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Kelly.
Okay, so this one is called Like a Dream. The moment we learned, the day we wept, the torture we endured. The day we learned, came to know that a vicious cancer was overtaking your frail and sweet body. This day, this very day, is still like a dream, a waking nightmare, a shadow that trails. a haunting that echoes. Nothing could prepare for that moment, nor the ones that shall follow. No dream, no nightmare, no vision could project the feeling of numbed, shocked, disabled energy. Disabled from connecting to the nerve of life, understanding this path, internalizing the sorrow. There is no way to really cope nor to know what the journey will unfold. But for now, it is like a dream. Hazed, blurred, shadowed vision, unable to clarify the reality and come to terms with this tragedy. Uncertain if it destroys, maybe it protects, maybe it shelters, maybe there is no real solution. The hope is that I shall awake from this dream, return to my life as it was. Maybe it is just a dream. So that was that one.
Very good.
Thank you. So the next one I'll share, I guess I'll share an activism poem. This one I wrote a
long
time
ago. Well, you said
you
wrote another one about your mom. Why don't you
hop
on that?
Okay.
Yeah, and then we'll transition to the activism poems.
So the next one I wrote, I started thinking about, you know, all the things I would miss about my mom, and I came to realize, because I had lived with my mom most of my life, is that it's really the little things that people do for you that you're going to miss the most when they're gone, things that you don't think about, you know, every day. So this poem is called Little Things. It is the little things, the normally thoughtless things, that seem to tear me apart. The edge of my heart is lost in shock sorrow. But the little thoughts jolt like electrocution. The reality that overshadows, like who will cut my hair? Who will ask me to call every morning, every night? Who will care if I come home? Or where I shall go. Who will ever understand the depths of my soul, what it means when I yawn or smile, what it means when I stare into space, comfort me when my heart breaks. Listen to my absurdity, be the arms to hold me, be the whisper that inspires me. Who will really be there when you are gone? Yes, there are friends, they are there, but no one can ever replace the warmth of my mother. The bond that we share, the life that made me grow, my shelter, my rock, my sanctuary. My mother has done so many things to make me who I am today, but it is the little things that shall evoke the special segment of my soul that only she can ever know. So that was that one.
You know, even the little, the irritating things of another person. I mean, she would call, you know, like clockwork, around 7 every day. And if for some reason I needed to go out on an errand to local mini market or something like that.
Right.
You know, if it's like, you know, let's talk at 8. I want to run out on an errand. She's so angry with me. You know, I would do anything now for one of those calls.
Exactly.
It's still unbelievably painful, you know.
That you take for granted.
Yeah.
You take it for granted when the person is here, but when they're gone, I think those are the things that you miss the most.
Something comes to mind that Danny Whale said, the education activists and labor activists that's in Ecuador. He's going to be a guest on next week, by the way. He was in a letter to me. He said, you know, What a tragedy it is that Gloria died, but he made the statement that, you know, my God, the monsters still live on in our society, you know.
Right.
You know, I mean, so we have people like Dick Cheney with his artificial heart, you know, he seems to be living forever, appearing on TV happily saying he's so glad that we had the torture programs, and, you know, and good people like your mom disappear.
Right.
That's just not right, you know.
I don't know.
Right.
Hopefully they're in a better dimension. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I know. Well, go ahead.
Okay. Well, the next one is called When We Cry. And I wrote this when I thought about, you know, what it means to cry and lose someone.
Yeah.
So that's what it's called. Life is fragile, like a dove. Within a moment, everything can change. Life can be saved, but it can be lost. Limited is our control. And in the moment when tragedy shatters, the glass house breaks, and the waterfall of unstoppable tears overcomes our humanness. To be human, to be alive, to be sentient, is to cry. Beg for mercy when we are in pain. Weep when someone or something we love slips away. Overwhelming is the emotional turbulent puddle, a shadow of our soul reflected, revealed deep within the core of the essence of our being. Evoking the fiber of who we are, what we mean, what something meant to us, what someone means to us, and what is meaning, what is the edge of the emotional feeling, what is the vacant hole provoking pain in our soul, allowing the sweetness and the bitterness to overflow into a whirlpool extracting all control, allowing ourselves to truly let go, be human, be real, actually feel the hidden fragmented depths of the endless sea of salty tears, pouring from the ocean's vast womb, the sky's exhausted breath, reaching for the glow of life, connecting our spirits from where we came, leading us back to the sanctity of what life truly means. This encased journey of solace and pain, joy inside the rain, echoes of our connection to each other, our connection to earth, our connection to something more. The cycle of life pours when we cry, locked in our tears as we cry. That was the end of that one.
Well, I'll always miss her.
I know.
It still gets to me how she died in my arms, literally died in my arms at the hospital.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Ruth Ann and I were saying, is that, you know, when you lose someone, you never, the grieving process never ends. It just, it changes and it subsides, but you always miss and long for the people you love and that you lost. But she was saying, and hopefully so, that they do exist in an energy form that they didn't before, and I certainly hope that's true.
As I said, I respect other people's beliefs.
Absolutely.
You know, I certainly, I don't know. There's nothing to suggest that. But, you know, I value what we had and always will.
Absolutely.
You know.
So the next poem.
The pain's always going to be with me. I'm sorry. Go ahead. The next poem.
That's okay. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The next poem is called 2 Months Later, and I wrote this when she had entered into the hospice. She entered into the hospice, I kind of felt like she was almost gone, like her spirit was kind of not in the room anymore. And
yeah, I remember when you called me from the hospice and you were teary-eyed, and it struck me that night.
Yeah.
And I knew I had to get in there as soon as possible, thank God I did, because
I could feel, you know, that something had really changed at that point.
No. And by the way, apparently that's unusual. That usually, from what I've been told, usually, you know, 3 days in a hospice is very abbreviated.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this was, it was too fast.
It was very fast.
But, go ahead.
This is called 2 Months Later. 2 months later, it is like you are gone, as if your spirit is no longer here. I see you weak inside your hospital bed, and I wonder if this is what you want. So much I don't know, so much I could not prepare. Just 2 months ago, you seemed so strong, so capable of fighting on. Even now, you are still so beautiful, flawless skin, bright brown eyes. But I see your body perish before my eyes, your soul attached to the pain, barely hanging on another day. I know this is not how you want it to be. You did not want to become weak. You did not want to be a prisoner to the pain. trapped inside weakness, unable to see. I don't want to remember you like this. I don't want to remember you as you are now. I want to remember you as you were 2 months ago, strong, a courageous fighter, a beautiful woman who always inspired me to be more than I thought I could be. I miss you, Mom. You are my friend, my mom, my comfort, my angel. I don't know what is to come, so much we can't seem to control. I don't know what happened, how so much could change in only 2 months. I will always remember every day who you were. I don't want to see you suffer. I hope to see you again, strong and beautiful. Please never forget me, because I still need you. So that was sad.
That's very, very good.
Thank you.
And you wanted to, you have another, go ahead, sorry.
Yep, I have one month later, I have one more poem. And this one I wrote about a month after she had passed.
Okay.
And it's called Nearly 1 Month Later. Nearly 1 month later, I still can't internalize how life goes on. Come to terms with the reality that your body is gone. I hope your spirit still lives on. I hope it is your essence making me strong. I hope it is your echo guiding me along. I pray that when the wind blows, it's your breath caressing my song. I pray that when I look into the sky, the rains are tears you cry. That the color in the sky is your rainbowed soul. That beyond the edge of the silver clouds, somewhere out there you are looking down. That your smile is the light inside the rising dawn. There are moments when I have to numb my spirit to all that went wrong. Watching your body perish, those 2 months cut nerves within me. And as your body gave in, something in my soul evaporated into your skin. Something inside me went into the wind. A segment of my soul is no longer on this earth. And a part of me only seeks, only wants to be where you are. I am not sure how long I can withstand lingering on Earth's land, not certain of the greater plan, nor how I can still stand. But I pray with every breath I take that you and Grandma are my light, still the angels that gave me life.
Oh, that's very nice.
Thank you.
That's very beautiful.
Thank you. So now I have three poems that... or activism poems.
Okay. What's the title of the first one you want to read?
The first one is called Breaths of Hope, and I wrote this one a long time ago. This one's rather short, but I wrote this when I first started getting involved.
Well, did it focus on a specific type of activism? Was it focused solely on the animal activism?
Or? Mostly environmental, but it's definitely mostly
okay.
About peace. But it's definitely about peace.
Okay.
So it's definitely more about war, peace. I wrote it when I was, I think, in Earth Ethics, but it's just more about
okay.
peace. Yeah.
Peace, okay.
So it's
especially needed in this day and age, which we seem to be trapped in a permanent state of war, literally.
Yes.
We can't get out of it. But, yeah, please, go ahead.
Okay. Creativity excites the passions of men. Sound heals the cunning sharpness of Grimm. Dark as the onyx of stone, bleak is the lifeless land. The world cries from affliction. Earth sighs from the killing that bloodies the land. Eyes look to their leaders, not knowing where to follow, confronted with all that went wrong. Weeping from the deceit that blinds, not seeing the beauty that can rise. Lives will be torn apart. Spirits will be lessened, and the thunder will strike with horror. But at the core, beings are still the creatures of great. Within the eyes of every man, there is optimism for light. Every land has an essence of dawn. every nation can calm the terror that reigns. Blood will be shed and souls will cry. But beneath the fire of hell, there is a world that can recover. Goodness is still in the hearts of every man. Within ourselves, we can mend their broken dreams. The wounds will cut deep. Passions will boil like a volcano. But those spirited voices can work to bring peace, peace that is longed for, calmness that can comfort the pain. Look upon the sun that rises, follow the clouds that linger. A brighter day is on the horizon. Allow the flames to fizzle. Let your breath blow away the ashes, songs of vigor, breaths of hope. So yeah, that was definitely, I guess, more
for peace. Do you feel that the world can achieve a state of peace?
I think we have a long way to go. I mean, I think I see it within movements, within people, within individuals, and within groups. But as a whole, you know, the world is definitely suffering. But there are good things that are happening, and there's good people.
I see it, you know, since a lot of the major wars have been pushed by elite groups. You don't really see people go out in the streets demanding war. You don't see that protest. But, you know, I mean, for example, the Iraq War, who put that notion into the heads of the public?
Right.
You know, I mean, that came from, you know, the wealthier among us. And I think that's something that, again, you know, has to be challenged by the people. We have to challenge the capitalism that allows this wealthy class to exist. You know.
We do.
What's your next poem?
The next one is an animal rights one. It's called Within Bitter Walls. And I'm reading it mostly because my mom, it was one of my mom's favorite.
Oh, okay. What's the title of it again?
Within Bitter Walls. And it's definitely more of a tribute to the animals inside factory farms and also fur farms. So I wrote this once I had really seen some of the realities of what happens to animals, and it was very was horrifying to me at that point. So
it's understandably so. I guess as some of the animal rights activists said, if only the slaughterhouses had glass walls.
Exactly. But, so this kind of is owed to that.
Yeah.
So Within Bitter Walls is a story, is a tale of life. Life's broken, shattered, torn, screaming for an answer. Inside the blood-dripped walls, every breath is in pain. Every moment is in terror. Every tear is unnoticed, cries without comfort. They die in vain. Helpless they are trapped, caged from freedom. Starved are their bodies, ravished is their souls. Awaiting their fate, knowing they shall not fade in peace. More torture is ahead. Suffering pours through the cracks. Bitterness chills every breath. Thrown against cold walls, knives piercing their skin, tearing through their flesh, breaking every bone, ripping away every fiber of their spirit. Never stopping, never thinking, mercy is never shown. Innocence is stripped, stripped of its skin, stripped of its coreness of purity. But we can cry, still pray, pray for mercy, hope for a new day. Feel the longing in need of an angel. Wings to save them, carry them high away from the torture. Escape from the blackened sorrow, free from the pain. If you could only see, only feel, only know the suffering inside the walls, your heart would break. But inside your weakness, you hold the power. The key to unlock the door, you could be that angel. Have the courage to conquer and tear down the walls. The walls that shelter evil hold in brutality, corrupt goodness, profit from death as they kill inside blood-dripping walls. So that is that poem. I know it's a little brutal.
Hello?
Sorry, I do.
Okay.
Had muted my phone, so
okay.
It, no background noises would interfere while reading. But
right.
it hasn't gotten any better, unfortunately, with the factory farms, hasn't
it?
It's become more powerful because now the industry is pushing to export to growing middle classes in China.
Right.
Matter of fact, you were telling me that some of the factory farms are becoming multiple stories.
Yes. Well, that's, I think, the vision that they have in the future is to become more multiple in stories, definitely. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's definitely not an end in sight. I mean, at some point, I think that there will be out of no choice because it's not sustainable. Raising animals for food causes more greenhouse gases than anything almost that you can do, more than all the forms of transportation combined. So there's nothing that you could do really worse than eating animals, animal products. It's one of the worst environmental things. So from a sustainability standpoint...
I mean, in all fairness, when animal rights activists say that, and I agree with them, you have to differentiate between methane versus carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both bad.
Right. But the amount of land, water...
Well, that's also true. Yeah, there's also the destruction of forests to replace it with...
It's not a sustainable way of living.
It adds to it, There's an
additive
effect.
And we can feed a lot more people. We can feed 15 times the amount of people. And with the increase in population, you know, it's something that... We're not going to have a choice at some point.
So I have
one last poem, and this one is more positive. This one is called Vision of Change, and I wrote this one. My friend had shown me the story of John Lennon, Imagine, and it inspired me to write something that's just simple because I was inspired that he had a very simple message that was very powerful and very poignant, and I wanted to create something similar that would have something of my own personality.
Okay.
So this is called Vision of Change. I have a vision of change, but I do not walk alone, nor is the premise unknown. Words of a harmonized world have so often been spoke, so easy to evoke, yet the flames fizzle to provoke. Shadowed has been the road to change of so many echoes and so much pain. The message of revolutions through peace, voiced in every message, edged in every breath. To fight against the powerful elite, to take a stand against inequality. To weave a blanket of kindness, to harmonize a world that seeks to divide. To heal the wounds of man's injustice, strength within their threads, persistence in their stand. Gandhi envisioned a unified India. Lenin imagined a world without war. Dr. King had a world without color, and all stood for something more. A mirrored reflection of a mission, a passion to seek compassion. A voice to sing in harmony, a flame to burn in unity. A vision of capability. To plant the seeds of change and grow inside the rain and not add to the soiled pain. Yes, I have a vision, as so many have had before, and I too yearn for something more, a world without any war, a revolutionary change where all species live without pain, and no one acts for mere economic nor empowered gain. An end to all exploitation, a harmonized web of connected life, living with Mother Gaia embedded in the clouds of desire. May our echoes provoke like thunder, may our souls ignite a spark of unbridled passion, and may peace encrust our core of sanctity to put into action our vision of change. And that's it.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Thank you so much for allowing me to share my work.
Very glad to have you here. Very glad to have you on.
I appreciate
definitely
you.
Also a very strong critique of capitalism, actually.
Yes, definitely.
So.
Certainly.
Which
which
has gotten significantly worse. Yes, she was giving anti-capitalist rants to the nurses toward the end.
I know, she was, yeah.
You know, so that was quite
she
remarkable.
She had a very bright and strong spirit, and I think that is the point, is even, you know, when we're weak and when we're sick and when we feel, you know, like we don't have the power, we still have opportunities and the ability to inspire others, you know, no matter how weak we feel. You know, I think she really embodied that message and that inspiration.
There were times where, obviously, I mean, all activists go through phases of despair,
right,
and so that's forth, and, you know, and damn it all, man, she probably deserves the parish and so forth. But ultimately,
right,
she never really felt that way on a day-to-day level.
No.
And she certainly never embraced some of the death cultism that's being pushed by, unfortunately, some that have, I would say, have fallen apart on the left. But, yeah, I mean, she wanted, she believed that man could change. And man has changed over
the
centuries.
And she showed that man can change, because she changed.
Yeah.
She was not
she
always
changed,
the person she was. She changed on a daily basis. And so she showed that we do have that capability.
Well, we do. You know, I mean, it's slow. It's painfully slow. But if man didn't change, then women would still be considered property, like they were a century ago, where they were property of the father, then property of the husband.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or if you go back centuries ago and 90% of the population was illiterate and toiling in the fields, and their wealth was extracted by a feudal class that was living high on the hog.
Yes.
You know, all the arts and sciences at that time, the only poetry that was written by those that were in the wealthy class.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else was able to learn how to read. You know, and so, I mean, it's been remarkably progressive changes over the centuries. So, yeah, we can change for the better. It's just kind of depressing how powerful the states have become and how their sole purpose seems to be focused on permanent war.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of climate change has become so serious that now it's talked pretty regularly among biologists that we're facing a 6 major extinction, about as great as the mass extinction that was caused by the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs, except now mankind is the asteroid.
Absolutely.
I think over the next century, it's 40% of all amphibians are expected to be wiped out. We have to stop it. And,
before we're the ones wiped out, because I think that's where we're headed if we don't.
No, it's...
Mother Earth could potentially survive and replenish itself, but we may not be on it. I think that's
I think. I'm not even that hopeful, because really the ultimate... If climate change runs its course, then eventually you would have an atmosphere that's very much like that of our sister planet Venus.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no life at all there. You know.
Right.
Oh, it looks like we're our theme song.
We did. We used up the time. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kelly.
That's
Kelly McNulty, poet and activist. And this is Brian Stetton of Progress Toward Democracy. See all of you next week, Tuesday at 8 o'clock.
Good night.
Good night, everyone. Good night, Kelly. Good night, Ruth Ann.
Good night. Thank you, everybody.